show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we've got some baseball to talk about, and we've got a little bit of maybe you might call it inside baseball to talk about this week that we'll bring to you. But first, of course, I am Jeff Herr. With me, as always, the incomparable Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this kind of dipping into fall type of weather, at least here in Kansas City? I assume it's pretty close to the same in Lawrence.
Pretty similar. Someone was saying there might be snow over the weekend, and
Oh, great.
I declined to register that as an option because I hate snow. So
yes, and it's funny that you decline that option because we have a special topic to bring to you today as we head towards this offseason, the qualifying offer and you, what it means to the Royals and to you as a baseball fan. So I think first we'll talk about, there's been a lot of confusion recently, especially because it just this past year, the new CBA went into effect or was signed, and the new rules are now going to be in effect this offseason. And so what do those new rules mean? Well, you're lucky we're here because we're going to tell you. So, and we'll after we kind of explain how everything goes, we'll kind of talk about the Royals free agents that could be getting a qualifying offer and what that means for them and whether or not it's a smart decision to give or to not to, or to give or not to give is the ultimate question with the qualifying offer. So first let's talk about a little history here. Qualifying offer, it's been around for a little while, and the most recent CBA that was signed in 2012, what that did, there was previously before that, and since that is a while ago, we don't need to go too deep into that, but the qualifying offer system had a tiering system and all that kind of stuff, and it was kind of messy. You could sign someone mid-season and just offer them a qualifying offer at the end of the year and then get compensated for it. But so that was scrapped for a new system, which was just concerned with whether or not you offered the qualifying offer to a player at the end of the year and where they signed. Now, one of the caveats there was the player had to be with you for the full season. So there was no more mid-year acquisitions that people – because that was a strategy that some of the smaller market teams started to employ where they could acquire somebody mid-season. You saw the Rays do this a few times. You could acquire somebody mid-season even though you were out of the race and not you're not really needing to acquire somebody, but do it for the – knowing you would give them a qualifying offer, and then if they signed somewhere else, you'd get compensated for it. And the Rays, you know, not only utilizing that, but just in general, having lots of players that they offered qualifying offers to, were able to one year actually get, was it 9 picks in the first 60 slots?
Was it? It was a total of 10. It was their actual God-given draft pick for finishing the year. They actually won their division that year, so they were picking late, but they also received 9 draft picks as compensation within the first 30 picks, or within the first 60 picks, my mistake.
So
it's a lot of picks.
That's pretty impressive. So that's like 15% of the first picks, of the first 60 picks all went to Tampa Bay that year. So that's pretty impressive, and that was a way that they kind of – I think that was the first kind of wake-up call where – baseball, other team owners were kind of like, okay, we need to really look at this and think if this is accomplishing what we need it to accomplish, which is essentially the goal, I think, when the qualifying offer was first born, was to be similar to a franchise tag in football, but not as limiting, because the franchise tag is severely limiting, where if you don't sign for that team for this 1 year and 1 year only, then nobody's going to – you have to give up 2 first-round draft picks, and then you have to pay and you have to give them a guaranteed certain amount, and it's just – it's a whole mess in football, and nobody ever – I can't recall a time that it was ever done. I mean, maybe if it was like Aaron Rodgers, people would jump at the chance, but, you know, he's not going to – they're going to work out a contract for him anyway. So – but I think the goal was to give baseball teams something like that, because – and they didn't want to go full on franchise tag, because essentially a rookie contract is already a franchise tag. I mean, most mm-hmm. rookies in other sports don't, you know, sign 3-4 year deals. You know, I think in the NFL, some of the higher first round draft picks will sign 5 year deals. But that's about the biggest you see for new players. Whereas Major League Baseball, you know, you get – you sign that player and – you get years and years in the minor leagues before they kind of age out of that rookie contract. And then once they get to the major leagues within that time frame, then you've got 6 years with them. So with that power combined with the qualifying offer, it gave baseball teams a similar amount of power that other teams have in terms of doing the best that they can to retain their players, especially to try and somewhat even the playing field for smaller market teams. But of course the risk is, well, other teams like maybe the Yankees or the Dodgers or whoever, they just come in and they just bid over the top. They don't even care what the qualifying offer is. They're just going to pay a bunch of money anyway. So what does it matter? So then the flip side of that becomes, okay, well, we still have to find a way to, you know, we've given a little bit of power to try and even the playing field, but then let's give some compensation here to the teams that lose the player. And what they had decided on for the CBA, the 2012 CBA, was the qualifying offer, which is the average salary of the top 125 contracts in Major League Baseball. That average is the qualifying offer. That is provided to a player at the end of the league year. They previously had 7 days to decide whether or not they were going to take the offer. If they decided not to take the offer, then they become, you know, free agent and they go out and negotiate on the market. And then regardless of the contract situation or the team that signs them, if they were signed and the team that signed them – so if the Royals gave a qualifying offer to a player and that player was signed by the Yankees or the Angels or the Orioles or even the Rays, then that team – loses their first – I should use past tense because it's no longer like this. But that team would have lost their first-round draft pick, and then the Royals would have been rewarded with a compensatory pick in between the first and second round, which people were calling the sandwich round. The only other slight tweak to that was if you had a top 10 pick and you signed – somebody who had received a qualifying offer, the top 10 picks were called protected. So if you had a protected pick, it meant you had a pick in the top 10. So you wouldn't lose a top 10 pick just because you signed somebody who had a qualifying offer. But the other team who you signed that person from would still get the compensatory pick. So the idea behind that being, you know, if you're a team that's performed really poorly and you have a pick at the very, you know, at the top of the draft, but you're trying to get better, you're going out, you're spending money, you're trying to sign other players along with getting these high draft picks, you're not going to get penalized if you have that high of a draft pick and you had done that poorly in previous years. So again, they're trying to make it easier to still kind of tip the competitive balance a little bit and give a little bit more parity to the lower teams in the kind of lower half of the league, the have-nots, if you will, at the time. So now the problem with that, maybe the biggest concern that people had and something that started to develop, and you saw this with players like Irvin Santana, you know, who was who played for the Royals for 2013. So yeah. What would happen is you had players who would get a qualifying offer from a team, and the other team that wanted to sign them would not want to give up their first round pick in order to sign a player. Specifically, you know, you have those mid-level market players. If Bryce Harper or Mike Trout gets a qualifying offer, You gladly you give up the next 10 first round picks to sign one of them. So that's not an issue, but it becomes an issue when it's your mid-level players, when it is your Irvin Santanas, you know, when it is your
Kendrys Morales is a good example.
Kendrys Morales, exactly, very good. And then I don't want to Lorenzo Cain, as far as talent wise, is not a mid-level player, but because of his age, he kind of fits into that mid-level contract type of. We'll get to that in a little bit, but point being, you know, players that were in that middle range that weren't like no-brainers for signing no matter what, and weren't no-brainers the other way of no way we'd sign this person even if there wasn't a qualifying offer. You know, the players in that middle there were the ones that were most affected because they may be somebody you want to sign to bolster your team, but maybe not somebody that you want to give up that pick for. So put them in a tough situation because they were behind the eight ball with negotiating. The other team knew that they had the advantage, and then if they didn't find any, they couldn't work out a deal, and a team didn't want them enough to sign them. The only recourse they had was to wait until after June of the following year, so halfway through the season, and then they could sign, and the team that signed them would not have to give up a pick, or would not have to give up their top 10, their unprotected draft pick in the first round. So
they'd already used the selection. So
yeah, exactly.
The draft was done.
Exactly. But then you've got a player who's coming in who didn't have spring training, who didn't have half the year, who's not in the groove. You know, and these are finely tuned athletes. They can stay in shape, but you know, being in game shape, being used to that, I mean, that takes a little bit. That's why you have so many spring training games. That's why people talk about, you know, not judging a season inside the first 40 games. There's so much of that rhythm of a season to get into, and that gets lost completely by a player. And they're going to jump in and try and perform in the middle of the season, and people are – the expectation is still going to be what the player should be. But without all that lead-in, without all that getting into the rhythm of a season, it's very, very difficult. And players really did not like having to sit out that long to avoid the qualifying offer and sign with a team that wanted them and that they wanted to sign with, but maybe just not quite enough. So there were definitely some issues with the previous system and how it worked. And so, again, the baseball and Major League Baseball and the teams and owners decided, okay, we need to look at this again and find a new method. And then with this most recent CBA, they've changed it. So why don't you give a rundown of the new changes that we'll now be dealing with as we head into this offseason, Mike?
Okay. The key thing that really changed about all of this is that, well, the players' union didn't want any strong deterrence that would prevent teams from signing players. So in the example of Kendrys Morales, you know, he ended up signing with the Twins in June, had to join the roster immediately because you couldn't put him on the disabled list. You couldn't send him to the minors. So he really did struggle. But at the same time, there were other players that missed out on other contracts, maybe larger contracts. If a team was faced with signing one player and losing a draft pick or signing a similar player for about the same amount of money, they're probably going to go with the other player and keep the draft pick. So baseball changed it so that your draft pick compensation, instead of forfeiting the first round selection, you forfeit a later selection. And what's really important here is to separate teams into three categories. There are your teams that pay the luxury tax, who are over a certain period or a certain amount of money for their payroll for a season, and they will pay in to a general collection that is then redistributed to the revenue sharing teams, which are your lower market teams. The Royals have always really been in that spot. Arizona and others are in that kind of territory. And then there's everybody kind of in between, the teams that don't receive revenue sharing and the teams that don't pay into luxury tax. And the system is set up so the basics are the same. At the end of the year, you're going to get a decision to make the qualifying offer to a free agent. It's going to be the average of the top 125 salaries, again, as it was in the previous CBA. If they decline it, then they become free agents, and that compensation is automatically attached. However, the type of draft pick forfeited by the team that signs that player changes. If you are a team that receives revenue sharing and you sign that player, what you're going to give up is it's going to be your third highest remaining draft pick. So if you have, you know, your regular 10 draft picks and nothing else, no other compensation picks, your third highest pick could end up being your third round pick. So you're going to give that pick up. If you are a team that falls in the middle, one of the teams that doesn't receive revenue sharing and does not pay into the luxury tax, you would forfeit your second highest selection in the draft. There's also a reduction in your signing bonus pool in your next full signing bonus period for international players. But the real kicker is if you are a team that pays into the luxury tax, and that's probably going to be the Nationals, the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Red Sox, and maybe the Tigers. I don't know if it's been determined who those teams are. You're going to surrender your second highest and fifth highest selections in the next draft. Still a heavy price to pay. You're paying two draft picks, but it's not a first round pick. And that appeases the players union because now that great deterrent is out of the way. It's still, you know, it's still something that a large market team does need to consider, but you know, they get to keep their first round draft pick. The other element of this is that that same categorization of teams will apply when you are compensating teams for losing their free agents. So in the same kind of groupings, if you are a team that pays into the luxury tax, you will receive a draft pick that immediately follows the fourth round. So because you're paying the luxury tax, you're building up that big payroll, your draft pick doesn't turn out to be as well. If it ends up that you're a team in the middle, your draft pick will follow the second round, which actually it's going to follow the competitive balance, the round B. There's a round A and a round B. So it's basically just before the third round is where your pick will fall. But if you're a team that receives revenue sharing, and that is the Royals, and that's what's most pertinent to this episode, you will receive a selection that immediately follows the first round of the draft with one condition. And that one condition is if the player who signs the contract signs one with a guarantee of $50 million or more. If they sign below that, then it will fall in with the clubs that fall into the middle, that selection just before the third round. So basically, it goes along that the Royals have a decision to make with these players where they either will make this offer, and the qualifying offer is going to be a figure of $17.4 million for 1 year, and that 1 year and that rate is pretty important to keep in mind. If they make a qualifying offer to those players, they have the opportunity to either have the player accept or decline, and the Royals would get compensation. So it really comes down to once they've made the offer, they're either keeping the player or they're getting compensation. The biggest change is really that designation between teams that receive revenue sharing and teams that pay in because of the luxury tax. And it does get around that first round penalty, it is still pretty heavy for those high salary teams that pay into the luxury tax. So those dynamics are all in play as we head into this offseason. In theory, it could have been last offseason, but the agreement was agreed to already after the World Series. It was too late to really put it into effect, so they followed the previous year's rules. So this is going to be the first year to try it out, and the Royals are going to be an interesting test case for how this whole system plays out with the big market and small market teams.
Yeah, the reasoning for that, of course, is what we've kind of been talking about so far all this offseason, those main free agents. And I was in a bar the other day. There's a new bar that opened up by my house. My wife and I went and had dinner there with our daughter. So I couldn't hear it, unfortunately, but I saw they had MLB Network on, and the scroll at the bottom of the screen was reading for their story that they were talking about, you know, who are the marquee free agents? Who would you, you know, target in the offseason? There was a three-person panel. And as I'm seeing on the screen that they're deciding or trying to say what free agent would you really target this offseason? And one of the people on the panel picked Yu Darvish, okay. The other picked Eric Hosmer. So Eric Hosmer is going to get a lot of attention, rightfully so. And then Mike Moustakas will similarly get a lot of attention as a free agent. Probably not as much, but I think you talk about that $50 million contract being a pretty important threshold. I think both of those players are anticipated to very easily eclipse that amount. I would be shocked if either of them signed a contract for less than $50 million, legitimately shocked, unless it was, in fact, a one-year qualifying offer deal. Mm-hmm. Now, Lorenzo Cain's going to be really interesting. That is his free agency, besides the fact that he's maybe my all-time favorite Royal, and I hate the fact that he probably won't be in one next year. If I can remove that from the equation, it'll be really interesting to see how his free agency plays out, especially with this $50 million threshold, this new system being into account. Lorenzo Cain is one of the people that I think it was really – I kind of alluded to it earlier – was targeted to help so that it would be easier to sign a player like Lorenzo Cain, because maybe, you know, even though I wouldn't consider him mid-tier in terms of talent, you know, I think his age coming into effect and his injury history coming into play puts him in that category where I don't know that teams would be willing to make a full-scale huge commitment to him in the same vein that they would, say, an Eric Hosmer or Mike Moustakas. So it'll be really interesting to see how that'll develop, especially because there's a good opportunity, a good chance that he could get a contract that's in that three-year range for Lorenzo Cain, depending on how everything falls out with the rest of free agency and everything like that. So if some of the dominoes fall into place to where a three-year deal becomes the best option for him, then that means he has to make $17 million a year to eclipse that $50 million mark. So is a team going to be willing to invest that much in Lorenzo Cain for 3 years? And of course, the more years they add, the lesser that AAV goes down. But that'll be really interesting. But this whole thing coming into effect this season really kind of shines a light on where the Royals are on. It's almost reminiscent of what we talked about with the Rays, where they could have a situation where they have a bunch of picks thrown their way. So we're going to break it down here one by one for the major free agents and the kind of qualifying offer, the players who you would think would get a qualifying offer or who may be on the bubble, and whether or not we think they should get one. So the obvious one is Eric Hosmer. You know, he's going to get a qualifying offer easily, and he's not going to sign it easily. And yeah, he's going to – oh, and by the way, did you mention the anticipated qualifying offer this year will be around $18 million, $18.1 million? Did we talk about that already?
It ended up being confirmed at $17.4 million.
Oh, it is? Really? Okay.
Yeah, the original back in like July, they thought it was going to be 18.1, and then it came out at 17.4, which
– oh, okay. Oh, my bad.
It's 17. Fine. Yeah, I mean, that was the territory. I mean, when you get to that level, what's $700,000? Really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to sign somebody for 17.4, you're going to sign them for 18.1 right. for 1 year. Absolutely.
Right.
So
it's basically Eric the same, Hosmer. But technically 17.4 is what's reported now. So
yeah, and I would be I'd be pretty surprised, honestly, no matter what deal Eric Hosmer signs, if he makes less than $17 million per year on any deal that he signs, unless it were like a 10-year deal or something, which he's not going to get a 10-year deal. So
right.
But everything else remains true. He's going to get the offer. He's going to decline it. He's going to be a free agent. He's going to sign a contract greater than $50 million. So the Royals are likely to get kind of the best, highest level compensation for him, because the all indications are that he will end up going to one of the higher market teams. And, you know, if he goes to – there's a lot of talk about Boston right now, that he makes a lot of sense for Boston. There's always been that kind of talk about New York, because he grew up a New York Yankees fan, and Mark Teixeira retired recently. Now they have what's his name? Bird?
Greg Bird.
Yep.
Had
so they've
pretty
got,
good playoffs. Decent.
Yeah. So they've got him who they think could do a good job. So maybe the Yankees aren't as much of a aren't going to be as much in the running as people thought before, if they are at all, depending on how they feel about how well Bird can do. But point being, if he goes to that top market team, signs a big contract, the Royals are going to get the best possible compensation for him. So that seems like a slam dunk. So would you agree that Eric Hosmer is worthy of a qualifying offer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's exactly the kind of reason why you attach compensation to departing free agents for small market teams, because he is a guy, you know, the Royals are not going to be able to re-sign him, more than likely.
And they're going to try.
If they're going to try, yeah. And another thing we should note is making the qualifying offer isn't the only shot that a team has at signing those guys. We saw that with Alex Gordon. They gave him a qualifying offer. He declined it, tested the market, did come back and re-sign. So the Royals can still negotiate a long-term deal. It's just that he's free to negotiate with every other team. But this gives them that kind of backup plan that, okay, he's going to be leaving most likely. I mean, you bet the field most of the time on these kind of things. But they still will get some kind of draft pick back. And when you're talking about Eric Hosmer, 28 years old as of yesterday, he's got his supposed peak years coming up over the next 4 to 5 seasons, coming off of a career year, has, you know, just his off the field presence, you know, all of the intangibles that you would look for. Yeah, he's as slam dunk a case as you get for crossing that $50 million. It might not be what he necessarily wants in the end. It might still be something that's a little limited, but, you know, 4 or 5 year deal at, you know, $18 million a season is pretty easy to kind of figure on right now. And so if that's with the team that is not the Royals, he's going to be one of those guys who brings back that pick right after the first round in compensation. You know, a couple of the things that might limit his market a little bit is because the Yankees, they have somebody they feel comfortable with. They are paying into the luxury tax, so they're going to have to forfeit that second and fifth pick in their draft. Is that something that is going to make them shy away? Possibly. Is that something that maybe Boston will jump on? Possibly, you know, so, but I don't think that's going to depress his market to the extent you would see for somebody like Morales in the past or Ervin Santana or whatnot. So he's pretty solidly going to be able to beat that $50 million threshold once he declines the qualifying offer.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't, part of in years past, you might think a player like, I don't know if you could throw Eric Hosmer in this ring, but with Alex Gordon, the way that played out when you talk about him re-signing, where he was given the qualifying offer, he went. Everyone thought he was going to sign with the White Sox, you know, and and then after Jason Hayward signed and everything, kind of the dominoes from that signing in terms of free agent outfielders, everything kind of fell into place for him to come back to the Royals, you know, and part of that. That qualifying offer, I think, played a little bit of a part in that. But as you said, I don't think that with the way the new system works, that it's going to be big enough to kind of add to that domino effect that would allow in an eventuality of Eric Hosmer continuing to be a Royal next year. So I think it does what it's supposed to do in that regard, that, you know, it makes it easier to invest in a player that you really want. So the next player, maybe a step below in terms of the free agent hype, Mike Moustakas, but coming off a career year for him, 38 home runs, Royals record, woohoo! You know, 38 home runs at Kauffman. I mean, teams around the league, they know how hard it is to hit home runs in Kauffman. So that's going to be they know, okay, you know, if you're the Orioles, right, you're like, okay, Moose hit 38 home runs in Kauffman. That's 45 at Camden. You know, the Boston right. saying that's 45 in Fenway. So maybe even 50 there. Who knows? But that carries some weight. But anyway, you know, I think he's another – I think you'll probably agree with me on this one. He's another slam dunk that he's going to get the qualifying offer. He's going to sign a contract over $50 million. And, you know, depending on where he goes, again, if it's another – Boston was another team that was brought up earlier earlier in the season while the season was still going, or at least season's still technically going on, but while the Royals were still playing in the regular season. And then even now, kind of into the very, very beginnings of kind of the end of the season and the off season, Boston was kind of talked about, but I feel like that's died down a tad. So it's not really clear. It's not clear where any of these guys will end up, but right. He's a bit of a bit more of a wild card because, you know, everyone, I mean, first baseman, you know, you don't expect a ton from them defensively. If they can give it to you, that's great. But, you know, you want them to be good hitters, mashers. You know, David Ortiz, granted he was a DH for most of his career, but you know, he did play first base.
He so sure that, that, did.
Shows, that shows you what they, you know, what you can allow yourself
Mike
to
Mike Napoli.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Billy Butler.
Billy Butler, yeah. Who I would say is underrated as a first baseman, but it's really stretching it, and that's not what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. That's a different story.
You can go listen to our 2014 episodes for that.
Yes,
discussion.
You absolutely can, because it was discussed. But, you know, so Eric Hosmer is really good at first base, but you don't necessarily sign him for his defense. But if you're going to sign a third baseman, it's going to be a bit more of a focus. You know, you still want the bat, but Moose clearly has that. But with his injury coming off of, you know, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt as a Royals fan that this year some of his decline was not only due to the injury that he dealt with during the year, but coming back from an ACL tear when your whole – job defensively is lateral movement from side to side and pushing off that knee, you know, that's tough. So, you know, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, but how much, if you're going to invest a lot of money in him as a free agent, how much of that are you willing to give as a team that's targeting Moose to be signed? So he, in terms of the, you know, what he may end up getting, it's probably going to be less than what Hosmer gets, but definitely eclipsing that $50 million mark for sure, and definitely think he's someone that the Royals will give a qualifying offer and should get one. And depending on where he signs, you know, that'll be another pick that is going to be likely the best possible compensation from whichever team signs him.
Yeah, I would agree. He's definitely going to get the qualifying offer. He's in his situation, he's got even more reason to decline it. I mean, they're all automatic declines between Hosmer, Moustakas, and Kane because they want to test the market. But with him, he doesn't gain a whole lot by going back for just one season where his knee could go out again. He could have even more troubles. Like we saw in late August and September, he was really kind of struggling just to get through. And that's something that if you're trying to, like, cash in your big contract, your first big free agent contract, you're not going to take a one-year deal where it could go wrong. It's kind of like when your college junior All-American doesn't go to the NBA draft to play his senior season. It's like a lot of things can go wrong, and not a lot really helps your stock in that situation. So Moustakas is only 29 years old. He had a good 2015. He had a good start to 2016, and he had a career year, power-wise especially, but solid enough with the batting average in 2017 that, yes, he has seemingly bounced back from his early career troubles. I think teams are going to be willing to sign him. Some of those teams probably have enough money to go and give him a big deal. I think he's another one who, you know, you got to figure 4 years is what he's looking for, and teams are probably going to be having to offer him at least five to win the negotiation. So given that that's, you know, $12, $13 million a year to cross 50 on a four-year deal and $10 million a year on a five-year deal, he's easily going to pass that. So the Royals should expect to get that best compensation for him as well. So that's another, and this is a reason why when they were kind of out of it, that, you know, there was talk about selling, and the Royals had to keep that in mind, that the guys that would have the most value in a trade would also have value at the end of the year as potential free agents and as potential draft pick compensation. And that was a big part for me. That's a big part of what changed my mind about, you know, not selling these guys at any point, because you're going to get that draft pick, you know, and it's a significant one. It's, you know, it's basically going to be within the top 40 picks. So that's significant. I think Moustakas is going to be somebody who returns that type of draft pick for the Royals pretty easily. It's I'd be very, very shocked if he didn't bring back at least a $50 million contract.
Absolutely. And next we'll bring up the one that we've already kind of alluded to as the one that I think, I don't know if you agree with me on this or not, but I think it'll be most interesting to follow in free agency, being Lorenzo Cain. And again, to reiterate, I think from a talent standpoint, you know, I think he's pretty high up there. I would say that's tough. If I were to compare him to Alex Gordon when Gordon was a free agent, would you rate Lorenzo Cain right now higher than you did Gordon in 2015? That's tough.
I don't know. I mean,
because like
he's a center fielder, that's more of a premium position.
Yeah, and he's as good as Gordon is. I think Lorenzo Cain is better, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the pop that Gordon had. I mean, if you look at like Gordon's 2011 season.
Right.
That was better than Lorenzo Cain's 2015 season.
Yeah.
And that was the year that Cain was getting MVP votes.
At least on the hitting numbers.
Yes, yeah,
when
absolutely.
You consider stolen bases,
just
running,
offensively
and,
speaking. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Because talking about defense, like I guess I still think he's Cain is better. But offensively speaking, you know, Gordon, career best year, better than Cain's career best year.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, but that's really – they're really close.
Yeah, and I mean, with Cain, he's the athleticism is there despite his old man hobbling that we always bring up. That
yes.
Is always there. It's like when he has to, he glides to that stuff.
When he flips that switch, he's as good as anybody in terms of athleticism.
Right, and it looks easy. That's why he doesn't always get on the highlights, because it looks easy. He makes those really difficult plays routine. And it's a special kind of player in the field that can do that. And, you know, teams notice that. It might not hit SportsCenter, but and he's not that he hasn't made his share of highlights, but, you know, it's certainly not like a Kevin Kiermaier highlight reel kind of thing. He's definitely got the athleticism. He's got the track record. Maybe the power might be a ding that teams take on him, but, I think he might be the one who runs into, because of that age, that like 3 years, $48 million fixes into my head, because it seems like that could be a range for him salary wise. And 3 years, if things fall, that might be where it lands. You know, the other thing that I think about with Kane is because it's $50 million guaranteed as the threshold, there might be teams that are willing to game the system knowing that it limits the Royals' draft pick based on what they sign. The contract size doesn't matter for what a team forfeits. It's entirely market size for that. But if you know that Lorenzo Kane has had – he's 32 – or he'll be 32 once the season starts, or shortly after. You know he's had a bunch of seasons where he's missed games. What if you put in some guarantees, or incentives into that contract that are pretty easily met, but not necessarily met, but you can't rate them as guaranteed parts of the contract? So does that allow you to make the guaranteed portion lower, knowing that the Royals will not get the same kind of draft pick compensation, but you might end up paying the same or even more than $50 million over the life of the contract. That might be something that comes into play here. It might not. You know, what I think back to is that Lorenzo Cain back in 2015, just before 2015, when he signed his 2-year deal to basically cover arbitration years, his last two arbitration years, and just get the salary set and make it so it wasn't something they had to worry about. He was already asking for a 6-year deal from the Royals at that point, according to Jeff Passan. And so that kind of tells me that he's going to be going into this season after hitting 300 again, after hitting 15 homers, he's going to be looking for a 4-year deal. And I think that's probably something he could get. The Rangers seem to be really interested. You know, I think any team that wants to contend can find a spot and find a reason to be interested. So I think when it gets down to it, he's going to be a talented enough player that the only kind of question is if teams get creative and messing with the type of contract that he gets. And, you know, I still think that overall he's going to get the size of contract. I think it maybe there's a 10% chance a team is creative and can make it fit so that it's not necessarily guaranteed. But I would still say 90% confidence he's going to be able to clear that $50 million based on track record, based on his defensive abilities, and based on just, you know, the talent that he's already shown over a number of years. I think it's going to be pretty easy with maybe a slight back door to limit that. Regardless, he's going to get the qualifying offer. He should decline it because, again, there's not much reason for a guy who's going to be 32 to take 1 year when the only thing that can really happen probably is things go wrong. Even if he does sign for less than $50 million, the Royals will still get a pick. It's just going to be around later.
Yes, and, you know, it's that you said a 348, and that number sticks out to me as pretty real.
It seems as a number that right many, there.
Yeah, and a number that many teams would be very comfortable in giving him.
Yeah.
So I do think, though, you know, at some point, I'm inclined to agree with you that he probably eclipses that $50 million mark. And I think that comes in because 348 is going to be kind of where that market settles, and some team is going to get antsy and pull the trigger, and they're going to say, okay, we want this guy. Let's give him 4 years. Maybe you decrease maybe you take your average annual value down to $15 million, and you give him a 4-year $60 million contract. You know, maybe you can kind of feel better about it that way, about giving that extra year. But that kind of maneuvering and kind of messing with that's the how the contract is laid out kind of feeds in a little bit to the next couple people that we'll want to talk about. First one being Jason Vargas. I want to bring him up because I think it's a little bit more relevant for him. Talking about, you know, I think the Royals would love to have him back. Mm-hmm. I don't know what his price is going to be. It's certainly gone up from the $32 million contract, the 4-year $32 million contract he signed. I mean, we talked about it last week, so we don't need to rehash it, but for what Jason Vargas has given the Royals, $8 million is easy money. That was very money well spent, you know, mm-hmm. even with the year that he lost to Tommy John. But The question then, and we'll talk about this now more from the Royals' perspective, the other ones, slam dunk, they're getting qualifying offers. But Jason Vargas is an interesting case because he's 34, and who knows how much he's coming off Tommy John. You know, he was never a hard thrower anyway. And right. the question becomes now for the Royals, do they give a qualifying offer? Because Jason Vargas is in that kind of subsection of free agents that it wouldn't actually be outlandish to sign a deal because he had that great first half of the season, so that looked good. But then that pretty bad decline, but you could blame that on losing a year to Tommy John, getting fatigued after coming off his rehab, and you know, maybe after now having a full year under his belt and then getting a better, full, healthy spring training and everything, he'll be better. He can last longer into the season. You might be able to talk yourself into that. But if how likely are teams going to be to give a multi-year deal? And there's no way he's getting anything more than a three-year deal. You know, I mean, maybe you can get like a Rich Hill type of scenario, but I don't even – he's that's not Jason Vargas. That's not what's going to happen with him. So, you know, there's a really kind of weird area that he's in of, you know, maybe a team will offer him a $2 million deal, but if you're offered – $2 million, a deal from a team, 2 years, say it's $25 million. You know, are you going to take that deal over a 1 year, $17 million deal? You know, would it make more sense for Jason Vargas as a player to sign the 1 year deal and play it out for $17 million? And then if he does well, part of the new CBA is that you can't be offered a qualifying offer again, but if your average annual value is a little over $12 million on the deal that you didn't sign and you made $17 million, then, and you do well enough, then the next year you make, even if you make $8 million, you're still coming out ahead. So, and if you're Jason Vargas and you have, if you're standing and you could throw a baseball, you're going to make $8 million in this. That's just the way it is. If you're a left-handed pitcher who can give innings and get guys out, so if he just has a whole year where he's healthy next year, then he would easily get $8 million the following year, at least. So right there, that's 2 years, $25 million. And you know, the possibility is there to make more. So that's a weird scenario. I mean, if it's me, I think I actually don't offer Jason Vargas a qualifying offer because I think he signs it. I mean, are you with me on that? Do you think he would sign it, or do you think he wants to test the market after having a good first half and has faith that people realize that it may have been just kind of declined from Tommy John and not from actual skill?
Well, I think this we kind of brought this up a little bit with Ensign Volquez before, or at the end of 2015 or 2016. It's exactly it. You don't offer him a qualifying offer because he will take it. And I think Vargas does want to get some kind of multi-year deal. I think anybody, basically, if they have anything reasonable left in the tank, and I think Vargas is the majority of his season shows that he probably does, you're going to be trying to get some kind of a deal for 2 to 3 years, at least, and more if you can find it. But you also have to consider Jason Vargas made $8 million in 2017, made an all-star team, has overall a really good track record with the Royals, despite a significant injury that lost a lot of time for him. So if you're going to be offering him twice that salary for one season, yeah, it's exactly like you said. You might want that 2 or 3 year deal, but you'd be willing to just take it because in this case, that is kind of a chance to rebuild value, and it's kind of like a golden parachute of a sort. Because if Jason Vargas is bad in that 1 year, well, you've got your money. It's kind of like maybe you can sign, I would say, 2 years, $20 million or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I think that you would definitely take the 1 year if you feel like your market is to that extent. The other thing is, if I'm the Royals, I'm not going to be looking at Jason Vargas and thinking it's worth the risk that he might decline it because he does want that longer deal. Because the payoff is he's not going to get that $50 million. You're basically looking at the risk of paying Jason Vargas probably twice what he's really worth for one season for the chance at maybe getting a pick just before the third round. It just doesn't really fit for me. And I think the thing is that teams these days really aren't going to be signing guys to deals like that. I think about James Shields back after 2014, signed with the Padres, but it took him until February to do so. And at the time, it was a four-year deal at $75 million, but it was like immediately panned because he was already 33. And while James Shields has been really good, it was pretty clear from the get-go that the Padres probably overdid it. And it turned out within a year they were looking to trade him and dump his salary already, which they successfully did. But I think that's kind of the warning sign that, you know, anymore, if you're a pitcher, unless you're just like elite of the elite, you're probably not going to be able to get a really big deal after 32. And Vargas is definitely in that territory. So, yeah, I think if you're the Royals, you can't offer it to him. I've had a lot of people say, well, why wouldn't they do that? And big point of that is because the Royals could probably get him, if they wanted him back badly enough, they could probably get him back for like 3 years and $27 million if they really wanted to. And really,
but do you want to?
I don't know if they do or not. But they definitely don't want him back at $17 million.
No,
that's pretty reckless. Especially if they aren't sure if they're going to be able to contend, that seems like a lot of resources for not a lot of return. Even if Jason Vargas had a good year, the year that he would have to justify that is basically like if he repeated his first half in both halves of the year from 2017, and that's not likely. So it's you know, like you said, you don't give him that offer because he'll sign it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's exactly. Like, that's the biggest deterrent. You don't want him to sign that deal. It seems obvious to me, but I also, you know, I spend a lot of time fussing about this stuff too. So it's not a bad question to ask. It's just one that to me is pretty obvious when you look at the details of how this all fits in.
Yeah. And because I think that's the easy temptation is to look and say, okay, a 2 year, $20 million deal. Well, $20 million is more than $17 million. So why wouldn't you take that? You know, but there's a lot of factors that play in, and the odds of playing for $17 million and then getting at least a $4 million contract the next year are pretty high, and he's already coming out ahead. So,
right.
Next, and we'll wrap up with this one, is Alcides Escobar. So we've kind of talked about him in general and whether or not we want him back at the team. And if you've listened to the show, you probably know which direction we're going to go with this. But, you know, he's another guy that, you know, he's not as old as Vargas or Kane. How old is he? I can't remember. Is he 30?
30. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's not as old as Kane. He's not as old as Vargas. Still technically, and I mean that in the most absolute sense of the word, technically in his hitting prime. But he's had his issues the last couple of years. You know, he's been one of the worst everyday hitters in Major League Baseball. But we don't need to rehash all that. What we're really trying to get at here is, you know, he's another guy that when you look – in that Jason Vargas category of, okay, what kind of a deal is he going to get on the open market if he were to go? And, you know, most teams at this point, maybe 2 years ago, especially after, you know, how he played, you know, being ALCS MVP and playing, you know, leading off the World Series with the inside the park home run and all the rest, you know, maybe he might have, you know, been able to ride that hype into a pretty decent contract. But and as of now, teams have kind of caught on in terms of a reputation standpoint, what kind of player he is. Not to say that he's you know, terrible, even though if you were to just look at it on paper, you might say that offensively, definitely. Right. But I don't think there's going to be a bunch of teams knocking down his door to try and give him an absolutely huge contract. Definitely not more than 3 years, I think. I mean, if Lorenzo Cain's not going to get 3 years, even though Escobar's younger, you're definitely not going to invest more than that in a player like Escobar, because at least Cain has the talent and the production to back it up, whereas, especially over the last couple of years, Escobar hasn't. You know, offensively, for sure, and then defensively, he's even started to decline as well. So if you were to try and offer him a contract, or I'm sorry, a qualifying offer, in order to get some sort of compensation back, you're likely going to be disappointed, because I think Escobar, even more so than Vargas and quicker than Vargas, would be the first person to sign that deal. Mm-hmm. I think in all of Major League Baseball, if everyone got offered that qualifying offer, everyone who got offered a qualifying offer, if Escobar was one of them, I think he might be the first person to sign before the ink was dry on the offer itself. Just because, I mean, 2 years, $17 million seems pretty reasonable for an Escobar contract, I think, at this point, to be honest. So a 1 year, $17 million just seems like a no-brainer. And then, you know, if you're Escobar, people know what you're getting at this point. So you're a year older, you know, you're not going to be that much slower in terms of, you know, defense, and your offense, everyone knows your offensive production is going to stink anyway. So if you're going to get the qualifying offer, you're going to sign it. And then the next year, you just try it again, and not much is going to change. So whatever contract you would have signed this year, you're probably going to sign next year too.
Yeah, there's he made $6.5 million this year. You know, back in 2012, he signed an extension that basically for 6 years got him about $22 million. You know, and granted, a lot of that was just buying out arbitration years and such, and it was very much a young player extension, but. Yeah, if you offer him $17 million, he will stay. He will gladly take that because I think, like you said, 2 years, $17 million is probably around the range you'd expect. You also have to consider that you will have to find a team out there that likes Alcides Escobar more than the Royals. I'm not sure that team exists, so it's like he'd probably just return anyway. There's a good chance they might re-sign him just anyway. It just doesn't matter. And I think that they feel like they could probably bring him back on something like that 2 years, $17 million, or maybe it's 3 years and 28, I don't, you know, whatever. It, relatively small, but probably more than Escobar needs to make. So in that case, just functionally, they don't need to offer it to him because they probably feel like he'd gladly re-sign with them. But when you also fit in the fact that teams, even though it's not a first round pick that they would forfeit, they still would have to forfeit a pick. And I don't know if there's a lot of teams out there that would want to forfeit a draft pick and pay multi-year deal for Alcides Escobar. So it's a lot of the same territory that you run into with Vargas, that you don't offer because he would take it. And then you have to overpay a guy. Plus it's the slimmest chance that if he did decline it, you'd get anything better than, and not to sneeze at the draft pick level that the Royals would get, but, you know, the reason you do this is to get that first round pick. And Escobar would not bring that back. That's a weird consolation gift to try to get at a pretty high risk. So it's just, it's not something that they need to do. You know, maybe I'm misreading it, and they're comfortable enough with Raul Mondesi that they wouldn't even, if the qualifying offer was $6 million, they wouldn't even go for it. I don't know, but he's pretty easy to me to be like he can, you know, test the market as far as I'm concerned. I don't want him to come
test
back.
Test it, yes.
Yeah, I really don't. I'm ready to move on. He had his contributions, but yeah, as a
they
hitter,
won't be forgotten.
No, that leadoff inside the park homer was awesome. It was super cool. Thanks. here's your gold watch.
Here's your trophy. You know,
enjoy Milwaukee or wherever you end up.
Wouldn't that be funny?
It would be funny. So, yeah, it's another one where it might seem like, yeah, the Royals want to bring him back. Why would they not make this offer to him? It's really the money. It's just you can't make that offer. Under, like, the old system, maybe they would, because then it just was a matter of you offer arbitration. And, it's, you know, you go into the regular arbitration proceeding, and it's fine. It's, you know, you exchange figures and meet in the middle, and then it's different. But here the risk is that you have to lay out that huge number for a player that really doesn't deserve it. And Escobar wouldn't. You know, I mean, he'll latch on someplace and maybe back in Kansas City, but it's not going to be at $17 million a year.
No, definitely not.
Not at all.
No. So that's all that we wanted to cover in terms of the qualifying offer. There's
I do have one other little wrinkle that kind of wraps all of it up here. Just
go for it.
Because the Royals, and I think the Royals expect Kane, Moustakas, and Hosmer to all return those first-round picks. That would give the Royals four picks within about the first 40. Since nobody loses a first-round pick anymore, it's going to be 30 picks to start off, and then you get into your compensation round. And the Royals also get a competitive balance pick, which is going to follow the compensation picks. So they're probably going to have like five picks in the first 45 or so picks. Based upon what the slots were in the draft last season, that would basically be about $2 million for each compensation pick. The competitive balance pick was about $1.5 million, give or take. And the 18th pick in the draft was $3.24 million in draft slot pool money. So that works out to right there that's over $10 million right there in your first five picks. You're not even at the second round yet. So that sets the Royals up to work out to around, it's about $14 million if they got compensation for each of those three guys we expect them to, plus they get their competitive balance, and then they have the remainder of their draft, assuming they don't sign anybody that makes them surrender a pick. So you're looking at $14 million in a draft pool with five picks in the top 45-ish, top 50. Just for comparison, last season the Twins had a draft pool of $14.15 million, which included the first overall pick, which was about $7.75 million. So it's a significant amount of money. It would give the Royals some flexibility to kind of play around, kind of old school, where maybe they pick a guy who people don't think will sign, but they can throw a little extra at him because they have a little bit of extra. So that's kind of what it all means. It comes down to is that, you know, the Royals, not only do they get the picks, they get that extra, say, $6 million in draft pool money that they would have available to offer to their first 10 rounds of picks. And that can be significant when you're talking about a guy who's picked in the fifth round, who is coming out of high school, wants to go to college, is willing to hold out and go to college for a couple of years and re-enter the draft. Because he's in the fifth round, his slot is somewhere around $300,000. Now maybe you can offer him $1.2 million and change his mind for him. Let's think about Will Myers in the third round, who was a first-round talent. The Royals gave him $2 million to sign with them and not go to college. It's a pretty good incentive. So if the Royals can maybe maneuver the draft in that kind of way and grab a couple guys who shouldn't be fourth round, fifth round guys because they have a little extra money. That's what it all wraps up to, is that they're going to be in a situation where they're looking to rebuild, and luckily they have a lot of money and a lot of draft picks to do it with.
That's a very good point. Very good point, where the draft pool being larger because of the draft picks. Big factor for the Royals. Not so much for the team signing the players, but definitely for the Royals.
Yeah.
So with that, I think that's all we wanted to cover. There are a couple other minor ones. We might just throw their names out there as players that we, you know, that could be on the bubble zone. Mike Minor is one. Hey! That was an unintentional, but it worked. You know, Mike Minor himself, he's got a mutual option There's a buyout involved with that, and then plus the qualifying offer on top of that, and then what he would get, and you know how willing teams are to try and pay. You know who knows how that shakes out. So that he's probably not going to get a qualifying offer, but you know it's an interesting name to throw out there just because he had such a strong finish to the season. So you know there are a couple others that might be on the bubble. But you know, not really worth discussing too much because we're probably not going to get the offers. We covered the pertinent ones. So,
and even guys like Melky Cabrera, he was acquired mid-season. He's not eligible for that. He also received a qualifying offer from the Blue Jays back at the end of 2013. I don't know, somewhere in there. So for that reason, he's also not eligible to receive a qualifying offer. So he gets to go play free of restrictions and draft pick compensation anchors. He can hug whatever people he wants to on the free agent market and get paid.
Yes.
Godspeed to him.
Yes, absolutely. and that's kind of interesting that Melky kind of checks both those boxes of being exempt from the qualifying offer because of being offered one previously, and then also because it was acquired midseason. Those kind of new tweaks to the rule, well, the not being able to be offered one 2 years in a row is anyway. So anyway, with that, I think we'll cover. Hopefully, that was informative, as well as we're always entertaining, of course, but. Hopefully it was informative as well. So when you start hearing all this stuff about qualifying offers and about, you know, what teams are looking at what and what the compensation will be, we'll try to provide paint a little bit of a picture there so you can kind of put the pieces together and say, you know, okay, well, the Yankees are going to sign Eric Hosmer for $120 million or the Red Sox sign him for $120 million or whatever it is, you know. Okay, well, now we know that means that because the Yankees are a team that pays into the revenue sharing and they're over the luxury tax and it's an over $50 million and the Royals offered him a qualifying offer, we know this is the draft pick compensation we're going to get. You can come back to this show anytime you want for a reference. That's the beauty of podcasting. So with that, we'll leave you. This evening, afternoon, morning, whenever you're listening to the show. Speaking of which, thank you so much for listening. We couldn't do this without you. Love you all, the fans, listeners, keeping us rolling. You're the reason that we do this throughout the off season. Because it'd probably be pretty easy to just let it go and pick it up when the season comes back on. But you guys listen, you guys pay attention, you interact with us. It's great. We love it. Keep it rolling. Thank you so much. Special word for our sponsors, of course. Always visit Kelly's Westport Inn. Fun place to be. One of the oldest bar in Westport, and having their celebrating 75 years now. Sorry, 70 years. I caught myself. 70 years for them. So always a good time. And of course, we always remind you to be very responsible when you do have a good time at Kelly's. And there's some resources there if you'd like to aid you in being responsible. Nobody wants anyone to put themselves in danger where they might harm themselves or others. So be sure to be responsible, but have yourself a fantastic time at Kelly's. It's a great place. And speaking of fantastic times to be had in the digital realm, going to bpkansascity.com, of course, you always have a fantastic time. We keep pumping out content. Dave Leske has a Whit Merrifield article that he posted today discussing the season he had and kind of what to expect from Whit going forward. So definitely go and check that out. And just as Mike and I do not rest for the off season, nor does BP Kansas City, we continue to put out articles, content, interesting things, especially as the free agency hot stove season heats up. Because we've spent so much time talking about who the Royals are going to lose. It is possible, believe it or not, that the Royals could sign a free agent this year.
What? Get out of here.
These things have been known to happen. So there'll be stuff to talk about as the Royals make signings, as they undoubtedly will. Maybe not many high-profile ones, you know.
Yeah, probably not a whole lot.
Probably not, but there'll certainly be some players that I think they'll sign, especially if they're convinced they can be a good help the team. And of course, this Dayton Moore to Atlanta rumor just will not quite die. Not rumor, but speculation just will not quite die. So hopefully soon the Braves will hire a GM or do something that will just fully eliminate Dayton Moore's name from being around, and people stopping to talk about it, and we can just move forward. But if something were to happen and somehow Dayton Moore were to leave, which I still don't think is going to occur, man, if it did, you know, that would definitely be worth talking about.
Yeah, we would have a whole new topic for the entire offseason.
Yes, that would make for an easy show, or right, easy couple of shows, probably.
Pretty much. But
anyway, regardless of what all happens to Dayton Moore and the rest of free agency, losing, signing, whatever, we'll be here to talk about it all in the offseason because of you guys. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week. Be sure to tune in. Until then, thank you so much for stopping by. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com. Every town has a place where elites gather for witty conversations over trendy cocktails. In Kansas City, that place is definitely not Kelly's Westport Inn. From its humble beginnings at the corner of Westport Road and Pennsylvania Avenue, Kelly's Westport Inn has seen it all. Pioneer wagon trains filled with families heading west, Civil War battles, and Major League Baseball championships. Kelly's is born of history and tradition, and we hope you'll allow us to become part of your history and traditions as well. Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri.